Good evening, guys. Everybody grab some coffee. I was thinking, since we're such a small group, that maybe we could go move upstairs into the nursery where the air conditioning is, but figured maybe that wasn't so practical. So it's a happy thought. But my name is Jillian, and I work here at the Vineyard. I get to oversee our compassion ministries, and so I wanted to talk a little bit about what those are tonight and then dive into why we're here tonight. So I've been overseeing our compassion ministries for just over 2 years now, and some of the parts of those, the compassion ministries that I oversee are the fruit of the vine. You probably heard about our food shelf. We serve about, lately it's been around 80 families every week. With the summer increase, and so it's a hop-in place for 2 hours every Saturday. We serve food to the community. We also have a prison ministry where we can send out messages to inmates from all over the country. We have about 20 facilities all over the U.S. that we send messages to. So it's a really incredible opportunity to be able to take whoever's preaching, whether it be Michael or Ben or Brenda or Chris or whoever, on the weekend and type them out and then send them to inmates because they aren't able to actually get CDs in prison. So we do that, and then every once in a while we do a free medical clinic around here. We've done 3 larger scale clinics where we can offer free medical services to the community, and we've been doing that monthly now this summer. We've been having a doc come during Fruit of the Vine, during our food shelf, and just see anybody who has a need. And so every week we've been doing that. We've had a couple fun outreaches as well tagged on with that. Right now we're giving away free backpacks for kids and doing haircuts. And so that's been a blast, just really providing a lot of practical needs to people who really need it. So it's really exciting to see what God has been doing and growing in our church just within the last couple years, and especially because it's just totally on God's heart. It's fun to be able to partner right alongside of what he's doing and get to play in all of that. So I want to talk a little bit about what it means really to have compassion. And you guys have got notes when you came in. If you didn't get one, we have more out in the lobby. But really, living compassionate lives is one of the two legs, I guess, that we stand on as a Vineyard. We like to think of ourselves as standing on two legs. One of those, the first one, is being worship. You know, what we tell God, what we think of God. And then the second one, it really is compassion, which is just living that out and loving people the way that Jesus would. You know, our whole, like, our motto here is love God, love people, period. And so we're finding practical ways to really extend God's hand out to people. And really, to live compassionate lives means that we're willing to suffer right alongside of people that are lost and that they're hurting and in need. We talk a lot, if you've been around at the Vineyard for a little bit, we talk a lot about what it means to have compassion on people. And really, Jesus saw people who didn't have a relationship with him. He saw them as completely harassed and helpless. And those words in the Greek really just means that Jesus saw people that didn't have a relationship with him. He saw them as completely shoved down to the ground. And more than that, he saw them as just filleted right open. So, like, all their entrails and their guts are just hanging out. And that's the way he saw people that didn't know him. And whether they have lots of physical needs or whether it looks like all their needs are met and they got the outside appearance of looking good, if they didn't have a relationship with Jesus, that's how he felt. He had actually had compassion on them. And really, the ultimate form of love is telling somebody about Jesus. It's telling them about the relationship with Jesus. And so if you really, really love someone, that's one way that you can show that in a really practical way. And so I want to talk about evangelism tonight because I really believe that it is the mission of the church. I believe that that the Vineyard, one of the things that sets it as apart is that we're a really missional church. We talk a lot about that word, and we talk about not being a church that just sits on all the good stuff that God's doing, all the miracles and the healings and stuff that he's doing in our lives, but we're a church that goes outside the walls and goes and tells everybody about it and does something about it. And so we don't want to just, you know, sit on those things. And, like, I don't know why, but the image I always get is when we're not missional is just being, like, constipated. You know, like, we have all this stuff in us and we just aren't spreading that around. And it's kind of like if you have all this good stuff stored up, it gets just kind of like moldy and it's just isn't good after a while. And so we want to go ahead and we want to spread that around as much as we can. And I figured out that one of the reasons why I don't do that as much in my life, partly is because of fear. You know, I fear what people will think of me. I fear I don't have like all the right things to say. I fear that, I don't know, I'll turn people away from Jesus instead of toward him. And so I think part of that is one of the reasons why I'm not as missional as I would like to be. But one of the reasons that that's been a problem is because it's putting me at the center. You know, I fear this, I fear that, and that's why it's been a problem. And one of the reasons why I think it's so important to share about our faith in Jesus is because even though we live in what most people would call, you know, like a Christian nation, there are still many people who don't know Jesus. And there are people who might have been like, yeah, I know who Jesus is, but they don't actually get who he is. And I was just talking with somebody today about how many people from the Vineyard go to Dun Brothers all the time. And so I have this thing where when I go to Dun Brothers, like I've been doing this lately anyways, and it's pretty cool, but I've been really trying to talk to people that I don't know at Dun Brothers, which is kind of funny because so many Vineyard people go there. But I go to Dun Brothers a lot, and lately I've been challenged to really go there and not just like talk to people I know or totally zone out and just read and, you know, put in my iTunes or whatever it is, look at my Facebook forever, but to really look and kind of ask God what he's doing with all these people that are kind of just captive. They're kind of just like sitting there, whatever they might be doing. And a while back, I was sitting at Dun Brothers and I was reading and I felt like God said to me, do you want to like take out your headphones? Do you want to have a little fun? Do you want to talk about me? And I was like, okay. So I took out my headphones and I was kind of looking around and there's this guy who is sitting next to me in like the little leather couch area and he was reading this book on how to distinguish which plants were edible and which ones weren't. And so it was a total awesome way to jump into a conversation because, I don't know, he just looked really interesting to talk to. So I started chatting with him a little bit and come to find out this guy is a Unitarian. And he said that when he was growing up and through college and stuff, he often got kind of like persecuted or like shunned by other Christians because Unitarians often just kind of like accept everyone and they embrace everyone and they'll just, you know, it doesn't really matter who comes through the doors, like they're all about it. And a lot of the Christians he knew were more like, how are you accepting all of that? And why aren't you being harsh enough? And why aren't you, you know, you're being too lukewarm in your faith and all that. And so that's what he thought about Christians. That's what he thought about just other Christians he had known. And he didn't realize that the message of the gospel is really for everybody, and that if you're really a Christian, if you're really a follower of Jesus, that you do what Jesus did, and you see that Jesus hung out with all kinds of people, you know. And it was really fun to be able to tell him about the Vineyard and tell him about, you know, I don't know, is it like 10 or 15% of our church don't know Jesus yet, but they still feel really comfortable coming here. And it's a very, like, come-as-you-are church. We feel really comfortable. You don't have to dress up pretty to come to church. And, you know, we let people come inside and we accept them. And it's not like once they give their lives to Jesus, we're just like, whatever, it doesn't matter about your life. But John Wimber had this saying. He's one of the founders of the Vineyard. He said that, you know, you can't clean a fish before you catch it. And it's kind of the same thing here. You know, we love to just open the doors wide open and let anybody come and say that the table is really wide and it's really big and anyone can come and have a meal. But yeah, we want people's lives to be transformed, but we do it through their love for Jesus. And so it was really fun to be able to tell him that. And I used to really, really fear conversations like this. And it's not because I'm not a very shy person, but I just really feared, getting back to that fear again, like, what am I going to say when he asks me that huge question about predestination? Or, like, I don't have anything smart to say, and I just didn't know how to make that transition. And I kind of just had to get over myself and realize that, let's just face it, I don't have this, like, list of really smart conversation starters. So I got to pick with like the things that I have. And I can small talk like nobody's business, but I wanted to know how to make those transitions. Like, how do you transition it from why are you learning about plants you can eat to do you want to know Jesus? Like, there's a lot of ground in between there. And I hate being awkward. And so I wanted to find out a way that I could really do that. So I've been praying a lot about just that God would show me how to do that in really practical ways. And I know that that I need to be constantly reading scripture, and I need to be like asking God to put things on my heart, but I also need to be just straight up relying on the Holy Spirit so that when I'm in conversations like that, that when I hear him saying, well, ask about this or say this, that I'll actually obey it and that I'll do that instead of just saying, nope, this is getting too serious. Let's talk about his cool shoes or something like that. Like, I want to be able to be challenged in that. Now, I wouldn't say that I wasn't afraid to talk to this guy. I mean, I'll say that, but I do think that something has changed in my approach really to evangelism, and something has changed just in my approach to conversations like this. And the thing that has changed for me is this concept that I can't fail. You know, I hate failure. I don't know anybody who actually likes failure, but especially with something that I'm so excited about and passionate about, my relationship with Jesus, like there's that thing in my head there, I'm thinking, if I talk to this person about Jesus and they're not like weeping on the floor by the time I left, I failed. And that's not true. We're going to be going through this book called Share Jesus Without Fear by William Fay, and it's in our bookstore if you guys are interested in it. But one of the things that he said in this book is that success is sharing your faith and living your life for Jesus Christ. It has nothing whatsoever to do with bringing anyone to the Lord. And once I understood that it's not my job to save anyone, it's my job to open up my mouth and to tell people I love Jesus and to talk about him, but it's not my job to convince people who Jesus says that he is. Like, that just took off a lot of pressure, and just this realization that God can use all of the fumbling, stumbling, bumbling words that come out of my mouth, and he can make it into something good if I give it a try, that's pretty cool. But he can't use our silence. And so all those times where I felt like that urge to do something, well, he definitely can't use it if I don't say anything, but he can if I just open up my mouth and give it a try. In the Bible, Jesus commanded us to go and make disciples. And when we don't do that, it's just rebellion. Like, that's all it is. It's not anything fancy. It's just if you don't do something God told you to do. And when I was preparing for this, I was really disheartened to find that it's like 5 to 10% of Christians have shared their faith with one person in the last year. It's just one person. And yet it's like this command that we're, you know, supposed to, this great commission, we're like to go and make disciples. And so I just think it's something that needs to be talked about. And because of that, one of the things that we've seen in our compassion ministries, but really as a church in general, is that we just want to see more people come into relation with Jesus. We just want more of what God is doing. And so we really just thought it'd be really practical and beneficial to do that, to offer training on how to share Jesus without fear. And like I was saying earlier, sometimes it's just hard to know like how to get into those transitions. It's hard to know like what are the right questions to ask to lead into the conversation that you know God wants you to have. You know, I could have asked this guy 100 questions, the guy at Dumb Brothers, you know, about his plant eating experiences. And, you know, he had some really good stories. But we didn't talk about that for the whole time because I knew that God wanted us to go a little deeper. And so I just really wanted to offer a kind of training where we can do that. And so, Michael, if you want to come on up, we are, we're going to kind of tag team it up tonight. Michael's going to share really the overall vision behind why it is that we do evangelism, what the Bible says about it, and then when he's done, I'm going to get up and talk a little bit more about the practical aspect of how do you actually go ahead and do that and ask some of the same questions.
Awesome. Good morning. Welcome to the Vineyard. You guys staying awake with all the warm weather? I always feel funny when it gets... Jillian, I was going to say, that you did a really good job. I especially like some of those word pictures, like the entrails and the constipation. That was really good, and I felt like it really inspired me. Okay, I'm going to be teaching a little bit out of Romans chapter 1. Here at the Vineyard, we absolutely love the gospel of Jesus. We are a church, we are a community that is centered on the gospel. We want the gospel to really be kind of the primary thing that everything in our lives, everything in our community orbits around. And we really do, as Jillian said, take Jesus' words seriously out of Matthew chapter 28 to go and make disciples. So we want to help people become students of Jesus. And really, that's introducing them to the gospel. I want us to know the gospel in the inmost depths of our beings. I want us to proclaim the gospel and like out of every pore of our being, out of every part of our lives. But the truth is, a lot of us kind of become afraid of this thing. We kind of begin to shrink back in fear. We're afraid to be ourselves. We're afraid to talk about that. And so I love Paul's statement in Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 14. He says this, "I am obligated both to Greeks and to non-Greeks, both to the wise and the foolish. That's why I'm so eager to preach the gospel also to you who are in Rome." Verse 16, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it's the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith." I want to take just a few moments. I'm going to break those verses apart and pull out some key points from that. First of all, verse 14 here, sharing the gospel, according to Paul, is an obligation rather than an option. Paul says he's under an obligation to share the gospel. That's a pretty different view of witnessing, isn't it? Because most of us kind of take lots of different parts of the Christian life, and we just kind of think it's like going and picking out a new car. Well, let me see. Do I want a CD player with a 6-disc changer, or do I want one with a 24-disc changer in the trunk? You know, which one do I really want? You know, do I want the headlights with the wipers, or do I want the headlights, you know, with the super white bright halogen bulbs? And it's like we think we have all these options. And what Paul is saying is that this is not an option. This is like part and parcel of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. There's an obligation. He's not saying that we'll do it when it's convenient. He's not saying that he'll do it when it's not a threat. In fact, it was a threat to him many times. He's not saying, "I'll only do it if it doesn't harm my friendships," or if I happen to feel outgoing that day, or, you know, if I didn't sin too badly in the morning, then maybe that day would be a good day to try to share the gospel. See, one of the lies that we've bought into is that the gospel was meant to be a private thing. And oftentimes people will say, you know, just keep religion to yourself. Religion's a private thing. The gospel of Jesus was never meant to be a private thing. It was very public. Everybody knew. Jesus was hanging bloody and naked on a cross in public, in the daytime. You know, this wasn't a little private thing. This is a very public thing that he was going through. So he never taught that our faith was only between us and God. And then Paul goes on and he says that he's indebted. "I'm obligated to both the Greeks and the non-Greeks, to the wise and the foolish." Paul is saying that we are indebted, we're obligated to the whole world. Now, there's two ways to be indebted. One way, of course, is you spend more money than you make, and you take out loans and credit card debt, and pretty soon you're indebted to somebody else for all the stuff that you've bought, you know, that you couldn't afford because you spent more money than you made. I loved it when we first planted the church here in Duluth. I called up a guy who was a treasurer at another Vineyard church. His name was Dick. I called up Dick and said, "Hey, could you tell me what, some key principles about like bookkeeping for a church? You know, because I've been in business for a while, like I know that kind of stuff. But tell me some stuff about church." He goes, "Yeah, Michael, it's really simple." He goes, "Write this down: spend less than you make." So I thought that was funny. Thank you. So that's what we've tried to do here in our finances at the Vineyard. So there's one way to be indebted, one way to be obligated. And that's, you have debt. You've taken out, you've spent more money than you're able to make. Paul is not saying that is how he's indebted. Paul did not receive anything from the whole world that he couldn't repay. When he says, I'm obligated to the whole world, to the wise, to the foolish, to the Greeks, to the non-Greeks, he's not saying that that's that kind of indebtedness. He's not saying, I owe the world the message of the gospel because they gave something to me. See, there's another way to be indebted. Someone can give you money on behalf of another. So say, for instance, I open up a bank account for my children. And I go put money in the bank for my kids, and they get like the little passbook, you know, the little savings book thing. They go to the bank, and the bank is indebted to give them their money. They didn't put the money in there. I put the money in there, right? But the bank is indebted to them to give them their money. You see, Jesus, through his sacrifice on the cross, has actually deposited something in our accounts. In our accounts. And so Paul is saying that God's put into my account a wonderful message that I owe to the world. He understood that the gospel was not just put there for him to enjoy all alone, but he was entrusted with this message for the entire world. Now, this isn't meant to be a legalistic thing that conveys guilt. In Matthew chapter 11, Jesus talks about that his yoke is easy, his burden is light. Our obligation to share the gospel is an easy thing. It's a light thing. It's a joyous thing. I actually get to bring the gospel, the good news, to somebody who's really struggling. I get to bring good news to them about their marriage that's falling apart. I get to bring really good news to them about their teenagers who are in rebellion, about the cancer that's just racking their body like a time bomb. I get to bring good news to them about the God who created them and how much he loves and adores them. Jesus, his burden is light, his yoke is easy. This obligation that we have is not meant to be a guilty thing. It's meant to be actually a really joyous thing. In fact, I believe that the story of humanity only has a happy ending in Jesus. That there's no real human solution to the human problem of rebellion. That the only solution is Jesus himself. Sharing the gospel is the opportunity to actually tell people the really good news that God absolutely loves them and adores them. All of our happy endings apart from Jesus ultimately collapse, don't they? I mean, have you guys experienced that as well? I think I found a happy ending, and all of a sudden it's not so happy anymore. I think I found the perfect person to spend my life with, and all of a sudden it's not so happy anymore. I mean, things begin to collapse pretty quickly if Jesus isn't the key component there. And I believe that nobody has a problem. Let me think. I'm starting that sentence wrong. I believe that the answer to everybody's problem is Jesus. That you will never have a problem that he's not the answer for. Like, you don't need a new psychological book to help you figure out this issue or that issue or this issue or that issue. That Jesus is the answer. What we need to do is learn how to appropriate his grace and his mercy in that area of our lives. So nobody ever has a problem that he's not the answer for. He's always the answer. The question is, how do we actually lead them to him? And the church, the followers of Jesus, you and I, we are the centerpiece of how God wants to help all of humanity. It's not centered on governments. It's not centered on, you know, going over and helping other countries get democracy. While that might be a good thing, that's not the hope of humanity. The hope of humanity is Jesus. And nobody ever has a problem that he's not the answer for. And we, the church, the ones who experience and extend the love and the mercy and the grace of God, are really God's centerpiece for doing something there. Therefore, in verse 15, Paul says, I am eager to come to you with this message. The reason I'm eager is because I'm indebted. It's an honorable thing. It's not a special or extraordinary thing. Paul says, I'm just paying my debt. When I come to you with this message, I'm just discharging my duty. I'm paying my debt. I'm doing the only thing I can really do. I'm indebted to come to you with this. And so I feel that way often when I talk to people, or when I have the opportunity to have a microphone and I get up in front of people. I feel like, wow, God has done so much in my life. I'm indebted to not just be funny. Not that I'm funny anyway. I'm indebted to not just like try to sound smart. I'm indebted to show people who Jesus is. That's the key thing. That there's really nothing else that I can give. They don't need more of Michael. Nobody needs more of you or me. What they need is they need more of Jesus. So I'm just paying my debt. Now, let's look at where the gospel comes from. The gospel actually originates with God. If you're in Romans chapter 1, if you haven't looked at that, go ahead and open that up and look at it. Romans chapter 1. Look back up at verse 2. Because there's a cool little passage right there. I started with verse 14 through 17. But look back up at verse 2 in Romans 1. Paul writes this, "The gospel he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures." See, the gospel actually originates with God. It doesn't originate with us, doesn't originate with Paul. The gospel originates with God, this gospel. And the word that's translated gospel actually means this long-awaited good news, kind of like from the front lines of battle. The word gospel in Roman Greek culture had to do with somebody bringing back good news from the front lines of battle. No CNN, no television, you know, no radio. They couldn't watch the Olympics going on, you know, 24/7 live on the internet. I love the internet. I'm so glad I was born in the 21st century. It's like I can watch four things. I can watch four table tennis games at once online. It's just, I'm sure there's better things to watch. Max and I sat the other day and watched BMX stuff, and the guy like dislocated his shoulder, finished the race one-armed, and then he gets to the end of the race, and the doctors pop it back in, and he's good to go for the semifinals. It's like, dude, that was tough. You know, and it happened in the middle of the night, our time, so I got to watch it on the internet, somewhat live. Anyway, where was I? The gospel originates with God. This is his gospel. It's not ours. So this good news from the front lines of battle, God promised beforehand, a long time ago, through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. You know, the Bible really is the story of God's relentless pursuit of the human race. When you look at Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3, you see how humanity rebelled and walked away from God. And when you get to the end, when you look at Revelation chapters 21, 22, one of the things that you see in there is you see that at some point God sets the whole thing right again. And everything that's in between is the story of how he is relentlessly pursuing you and I. The whole rest of the book is that story. And so what I love about what Paul says here in verse 2 is this gospel he promised beforehand, and the way that he promised it to us was through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. We see again and again in the Old Testament, as well as in the New, how God is, you know, faithful to his promises. He's going and he fully intends to restore you and I to himself, to restore what was lost that sin took from us. And he accomplishes that through his son Jesus, who came through the line of King David, the Davidic warrior king. And we know that the Son of God is Jesus, the Messiah, the one that God promised because of his resurrection from the dead. No one before or since has been resurrected in a bodily form from the dead. And we know from historical fact that that's true, that it really happened, that he really is the Christ, the Messiah, the King of Kings, who is now my Lord. And he is available right now and at work in every single person's life. Every person's life. John chapter 5. Can't remember the verse. Jesus is being questioned by the Pharisees, the religious people, about why he healed a guy on the Sabbath. You guys remember that story? The pool of Bethsaida. And they're questioning him. John chapter 5. And he says in verse 17, "In his defense, Jesus said to them, 'My Father is always at work, and to this very day, I too am working.'" That's awesome. Because what that means is you'll never run into a person, whether it's at Dun Brothers or at the gas station or going down the street. You're never going to run into a person, you're never going to meet a person that God's not working in their life. He's doing something. He's pressing in. He's inviting them into relationship with him. He's making himself known to them. And so this gospel originates with God. Okay, so the gospel originates with God. God's at work in every single person's life. He's inviting you and I to play a part in that. It revolves around God. It started with God. It's all about God. We can't make it about anything else. We can't make it about church. We can't make it about politics. We can't make it about any other part of life. It revolves around him. And we don't discover this because of self-revelation or self-actualization or anything else. We discover this because God reveals it to us. And so it's really all about him. It's always been about him. It'll always be about him. It all came from him. Does that make sense? That's a really big point, because we tend to sometimes try to make it about us. And then Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, verse 16. I don't know if you've discovered this or not, but it's more politically incorrect today to talk about the gospel than it's been ever since I've been alive. That you can talk about all sorts of different kinds of things. You can talk about anything politically or sexually that you want to. But to talk about the gospel of Jesus is considered generally pretty offensive. And there's four reasons why it ends up being offensive. The first one is this. There's a historical offense to the gospel. And I think it's good to understand this, because these are four reasons that generally, whether you know it or not, you and I tend not to share our faith. Because it's offensive. The first one is a historical offense. Think about this. The gospel centers on a legally condemned and executed Jewish carpenter. That's what it's about. What's your hope for life? Well, there was this Jewish carpenter when he was about 33 years old who was legally condemned and executed. That's my hope. It's historically offensive. I mean, it doesn't sound real smart. It's kind of like, okay, here come the loonies. You're like, they're the ones trusting in the guy that got executed on the cross, right? I love the way Justin Martyr said, one of our early church fathers a couple thousand years ago. He says this, they say our madness consists in the fact that we put a crucified man in second place right after the unchangeable, eternal God. That our madness consists that we give a crucified man second place right after the unchangeable, eternal God. It's madness. That's offensive. There's a historical offense. There's also a cultural offense. In polite society in the ancient world, you never talked about the crucifixion or the cross. It was called the infamous stake, the criminal's wood, the slave's punishment. It involved torture, tremendous humiliation, as well as eventually execution. You were stripped naked, beaten. You carried the implement of your death to the place of execution, hanging there in public sometimes for days, dying slowly, bleeding, dying, grasping for air as you eventually suffocate because you can't hold yourself up any longer. It's horrible. It's unspeakable. It was offensive. It's culturally offensive. And sometimes I think we just so lose the offensiveness of the cross. You guys, I don't think it was an accident that Jesus died on a cross, the most horrific kind of capital punishment available. I don't think that was an accident. I think God chose that because it's offensive. And when we try to make the cross all pretty, I think we do a disservice to the gospel. This was a painful, humiliating death. And so don't soft sell that part of it. I have a gay friend who now lives in Arizona. Minnesota was too cold for him. He's a really wonderful illustrator. And when the movie came out about The Passion of the Christ, the Mel Gibson film that he directed, I was talking with my friend, whose name is Ken, and he said, why would you go to that? Why would you go to anything so bloody? It's offensive to me that they made it so bloody. And I go, well, dude, I bet that it's not even as bloody as it was. And he goes, well, that's beside the point. It's offensive to me. See, the gospel of Jesus is actually offensive. It's not pretty. And there's a cultural offense in that. There's also, for those of you that are really smart, a philosophical offense. Some people get this right away. Some people don't get it. If it doesn't make sense to you, just smile and wave, okay? In philosophy, when you're studying philosophy, the universal establishes the particular. The particular always illustrates the universal. So like the universal law of gravity. We know that gravity is true because I lift up a chair, I let go of it, it drops, right? That's the particular, that chair reacting. But that chair doesn't establish gravity. Gravity's true outside of that chair dropping, okay? Not so with the gospel. Jesus Christ and him crucified is not an example of divine love. It's not an illustration of divine love. It actually establishes God's love. The particular establishes the universal. If you're a philosophy major, that's idiocy. That's foolishness. They think that's absolutely insane. It's wonderful. I love it. And then there's a moral offense. Jesus freely went to Jerusalem to suffer and die and bear the curse upon himself that's upon you and I that we could never pay for ourselves. That's the heart of the offense. You cannot save yourself. You're a sinner who needs to be rescued. It's morally offensive to tell somebody that they're a sinner who needs to be rescued. That offends people. You know, I like to tell people, you only need two things to become a Christian. You only have to come with two things. Number one, you have to come as a beggar, hat in hand. And number two, you have to come as a failure. I can't do this myself. I can't get to God on my own. That's the moral offensiveness of the gospel. There's no way to get to God on your own. Doesn't matter how good you are. Doesn't matter how much you do. That's morally offensive to people. So those are the four basic offenses of the gospel: the historical, the cultural, the philosophical, and the moral. We don't get to the heart of the gospel if it doesn't feel offensive to the person that we're telling it to. Now, I don't mean it's offensive because we're idiots, right? And I've seen idiots trying to share the gospel. And I'm using the nicest word I can come up with when I say idiot, walking around with, you know, big signs, you know, you're going to hell, you big sinners, you know. It's like, you know, if you're a jerk and people reject you, you deserve to be rejected. But it's the actual message itself that's offensive. Does that make sense? And there's just a big difference there. So there you go. The gospel, on the other hand, is the only thing that you and I don't need to be ashamed of. We've often got this totally flipped upside down. The gospel is the one thing in our lives that we don't need to be ashamed of. And we can't say that about any other philosophy. We can't say that about any other political system. We can't say that about any other person. You can't say that about yourself. Everything else, I have a right to be ashamed of. The gospel is the only thing in life that I don't have to be ashamed of. Everything else I look at, a church, the person, the vineyard. It's like when I really look at it, when I really examine anything else under the microscope, I find things that are just not right. The closer you look at yourself, the closer you look at anybody else, you find things that aren't right. You find things that you should not have said, you know, that you shouldn't have done, that you should have done, that you didn't do. We find so many things in ourselves that are offensive, not in the gospel. Only the gospel, when you really look at it, when you really scrutinize it, does it look better. No mistakes, no flaws. Absolutely nothing wrong. It's like that perfect diamond, and you're studying it, and you're looking at it, and you're spinning it around, and the more you look at it, the more perfect, the more flawless it is. Only in the gospel do you find that, not in anything else. So I'm not ashamed, for instance, of the historical evidence. I know that wherever I go, wherever I've attached myself to the gospel, I'm not attaching myself to just some private little idea, some private little trip, my own private experience. It's not just my truth I'm talking about. Paul went throughout the Roman Empire proclaiming that this is true. Now, you may have doubts about the church. You may have doubts about Jesus. But I've discovered, and I challenge people to do this all the time, if you really study this stuff, if you don't just throw the Bible aside and say, well, my dad read it and he didn't like it, so I don't like it either. If you will actually press into that thing and begin to study it, you'll find more and more and more truth there than you ever thought possible. You don't have to be ashamed of that. You don't have to be ashamed of the historical evidence about it. When you get in there, you'll find there really was a man named Jesus who walked around Palestine. He really did hang on a cross. He really did die. He really was resurrected 3 days later. And he's alive today. You can have a relationship with him. It will change your life forever if you have the guts to press in and look at it. And so I usually present it like that to folks. So I'm not ashamed of the historical evidence. I'm not ashamed of the gospel in the face of human suffering. There's nothing that causes someone to be more ashamed of their philosophies or their ideas than being face to face with real suffering. When you talk to somebody who's had a difficult life, somebody who was sexually abused, like I was for a number of years by a cousin of mine, when you talk to people who, you know, they have cancer, like a time bomb ticking inside their body. When you talk to people who are really, really suffering, they will often say something like, "So what do you have to offer me?" And our philosophies don't go very far. Our happy, slappy Dr. Phil stuff doesn't go very far in the face of the real suffering. It doesn't go very deep in the face of that. The gospel does. You don't have to be ashamed. My God understands the suffering that you're going through. My God came to earth, and he actually had nails driven through his arms and through his feet. He understands suffering. My God went through all of your pain. Now see, I know where that one went, but page two mysteriously disappeared. My God understands suffering in a way that no one else does. He knows what you went through. In fact, he was there with you every step of the way as that was going on. You don't have to be ashamed in the face of suffering. He understood what it meant to be beaten. He went down to the very depths rather than staying distant and aloof like Confucius. My God got involved with that. One of the things that upsets the Muslims about Jesus being God was because there's no way God could suffer. God is so big and powerful, he would never allow himself to suffer. Therefore, Jesus couldn't be God. That's part of what's offensive to them about Christianity, about who Jesus was. And then also, I'm not ashamed of the foolishness. Oh, I might be a step ahead of myself there. Not ashamed of the foolishness. You know, in classrooms and on the media for decades, in college classrooms, Christianity and the Bible have been approached as a force of intolerance, as a force of bondage that has kept people from hating each other. And even there's a whole new slew of atheists out today writing really great books and, you know, producing stuff. And one of the things that they're saying is if we could just throw off the bondage of Christianity and the Bible, if we could throw this off and we could, you know, get rid of this crutch of believing in God, then people could really be free. Then finally people would be free and they would treat each other better. And I like to think, well, let's think about that for a minute. Let's think if that's true, because it's not as if atheism hasn't been tried, right? Let's look at the places where atheism has been tried and see how it's really worked, you know? 2 billion people around the globe tried it in China, Russia, East Germany, and Cuba, just as a few. And what was the fruit of throwing off God? Did people become kinder and more tolerant? The fruit was concentration camps. It was gulags. It was prisoners by the millions. It was mass slaughters. Not much kindness, but hardness. Not much tolerance, but meanness. Insensitivity. If we look just at our world in the last 100 years, 200 years, we see the fruit of throwing off God. And it doesn't produce what they say it produces. And I'm also not ashamed of the weakness. Jesus didn't show up on the scene as a great military or political or national leader, but as a poor carpenter's son born out of wedlock in a poor area of Palestine. No other person in human history has been talked about more. Nobody else still appears on the covers of Time and Newsweek. Nobody's been talked about more than this guy who was born to one of the poorest families in one of the smallest, poorest areas of the world in his day. Nobody's had more of an impact than Jesus, the Messiah. And then the gospel really is the power of God. It's the power of God. Now, I am all for praying for revival. I'm all for, however you might define revival, by the way. I'm all for praying for more of the Holy Spirit, praying for more of God's presence, asking for God's power. I'm all for. But wherever the church has exploded in life and power throughout history, it's because Jesus Christ and Him crucified has been held up before an unbelieving and a rebellious humanity, and their response has been repentance on their knees. And the church has exploded in power when that has taken place. And so I'm all for praying for revival, but I am so much more for preaching the gospel, holding up Jesus Christ and Him crucified. That's the thing that has to take place. And people come to us all the time with major problems, looking us right in the eye. My marriage is shattered. My teenage child is pregnant. It's like all these messes going on in people's lives, and there's this tendency to try to solve those things, to try to address those issues. There's this tendency to feel like you've got nothing in the face of suffering. But Paul says it's not true. It doesn't matter what Goliath you're facing, how big your issue looks. It doesn't matter your addiction, your depression, your death, all these little rocks. This gospel message deals with the giant that's going on in our lives. The gospel breaks through in a way that nothing else possibly can. It's not just truth, it's truth that works. It creates change. It really is the power of God. When people embrace the gospel, even in their weakness and stumbling little ways that we embrace it a little bit at a time, God gets in by His Holy Spirit and begins to work and brings real change to our lives. Things turn around completely. There's nothing that the gospel's not the answer for. So the gospel is the power of God. The gospel is the power of God for salvation. And this word in the Greek language, as well as in the Hebrew language, communicates really everything that God has for us to set life right. It's shalom. It's grace. This word is bigger than justification, which simply means being declared right in the sight of God. It's bigger than sanctification, which means being made right in the sight of God. Salvation is all about God's blessing coming into our lives. Whatever oppresses you, whatever fear, you know, whatever shame that you have, whatever tough things that you've gone through, salvation is big enough to set you free and make you feel whole and well. Oftentimes, the Greek word that's used is the word that's pronounced sozo. And it's the same word that Jesus used when He actually healed people and said, "Your faith has sozoed you. Now go in peace." And it's like everything in their world that was messed up was just put right. Now go and enjoy it. Go and enjoy it. Go be who God created you to be. They'd been sozoed. And then the gospel is for everyone who believes. I would seriously be ashamed of a message that wasn't for everyone. This is not just for Caucasian Americans. It's not just for Americans, no matter what our color. It's not just for people who are literate. It's not just for people in third world countries. The gospel is absolutely for everyone. Absolutely no one is left out. It's not just for old people, it's for young people. It's for educated people. And Paul faced three basic responses as he went around sharing the gospel. He said in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he said, "We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews, foolishness to the Gentiles, but to those whom God has called, those who are being saved, it's the power and the wisdom to God." So as we share the faith, to some people, it's a stumbling block, it offends them, and they get angry. And when that happens, that's normal. You just look and go, "Oh, that's normal." For some people, the gospel, because of the offenses, is a stumbling block. And so sometimes I share the gospel and people get pissed off. They're just mad. Like, what's all this Jesus crap? Why are you always talking about Jesus? The gospel's offensive. And so for some people, it's a stumbling block.
To some, it's complete foolishness. It's moronic. It's basically, oh, here come the morons again. It's absolutely foolishness. But to those whom God is drawing to himself, it's the power of God for real life change. And those are the ones I'm going after. I know some will be offended by it. I just don't want them to be offended by my stupidity. I know that some will think it's absolutely foolish. I don't want them to be offended really by my foolishness. But some of the people, they will hear it, God's working in their lives, and they'll latch on to it. And I'll share it, and I'll offend a lot of people, and I'll take all the abuse they have to offer, because I'm just looking for those few that respond to it well. And I know that some of the people that are offended a little further down the road, they might soften up and respond well. So I don't want to blow them off, you know. I think that evangelism should be like the easiest, the most natural thing that the church does. And the enemy has gotten into our minds, into our lives, and wreaked havoc, because as soon as we begin to try to talk about this, we feel so embarrassed and so like tongue-tied. And I believe that Jillian's going to come back up. In fact, you can come up right now. Should we take a little break before? A short little break? Yeah. So we'll take a short little break, and then Jillian will talk to us a little bit more. What she's going to do is just give us some really practical tools about what verses in the Bible should we have highlighted so that we can show to people? Like, what? How does this thing actually work? And I believe that as we take little tiny steps and do that, we'll see God show up. We take little tiny steps, he comes running to meet us, and he does this stuff really well. So, let's take a break.